Welcome to the Deep Dive. This is where we take source materials and, well, dive deep to pull out the key insights for you.
And today we have something quite unusual.
We certainly do. We're looking at a chapter called The Untethered Perceiver. It's from a short story collection anthology by David Noel Lynch.
No, it's really important to clarify, this isn't the film director David Lynch.
No, absolutely not. This is David Noel Lynch. The chapter itself was apparently written by Gemini 2.5 Pro, but based on his outline.
Fascinating origin. And the content itself focuses on Lynch's own experiences after a really severe car accident back in 1977.
Yeah, it touches on some heavy themes, altered perception, near-death experiences, and interestingly, clashes with conventional medical views.
So our mission today, our deep dive, is to unpack the key moments, the core insights around what David Noel Lynch went through and, you know, what it all might imply.
Okay, let's jump in. The story kicks off with that car accident, June 19th, 1977. It calls it a rupture in the temporal weave, pretty dramatic language.
And the physical trauma sounds horrific. Visage nearly unmade, shattered nose, blood. Just awful.
But then there's this other element introduced almost immediately, this idea of a spectral doppelganger.
Right, an untethered, shimmering analog of consciousness that supposedly leaves the body. It immediately makes you question, well, what is consciousness relative to the physical form?
And while this, let's call it consciousness, is maybe having this separate experience, his actual body is facing some serious trouble back on Earth.
Accusations of fleeing the scene, recklessness, even vehicular homicide.
So you've got this stark contrast, this potential out-of-body state versus very real, very serious legal consequences.
And the impact wasn't just physical or legal. His parents noticed a profound shift. They saw it as mental derangement.
The mask of normalcy shattered, as the text puts it.
Which ultimately led to him being committed to Peachford Hospital. That was December 8, 1977. So the accident had these huge ripple effects.
He's really painted as this involuntary journeyer, someone thrust into these liminal spaces, these sort of in-between states.
And there's this suggestion that the trauma itself might have unlocked something. Maybe awaken this perceptual divergence.
Which is a thread we'll definitely see running through the rest of the chapter. Okay, so next, the scene shifts to Piedmont Hospital. David's father is sick.
Yeah, he gets there because of a cryptic note, finds his father in the ER, and the description is, interesting doctors consulting nearby, a glowing light box with an X-ray.
David seems drawn to that X-ray almost immediately.
Even before fully grasping his father's condition. It's like an early hint of this visual sensitivity he seems to develop.
And his father, who was a Marine, normally stoic, you'd imagine.
Right. He's clearly in a lot of pain, but the doctors are hesitant. They don't want to sedate him without knowing why he's suffering.
So David does something interesting. He doesn't argue or plead.
No, it's nonverbal. He sort of nudges the doctor, prompts him to look closer at that X-ray.
And when the doctor does, David just points to a specific spot, a grayish, whitish area.
And asks that really simple question. What is that?
That question seems to change everything in that moment. The doctor's whole approach shifts.
Immediately. He goes back, sedates the father, and, well, the diagnosis follows soon after.
A growth on his prostate. Just like David had somehow sensed by looking at the image.
It's quite a moment. It really foreshadows these later instances where his perception seems to pick up on things others miss.
Definitely. Okay, let's get into the core of his post-accident experience, what the chapter calls the thanatoptic sojourn.
This is the description of that violent shearing away of his consciousness from his body right after the impact.
It's termed a cinematic dissociation, an out-of-body experience. He's like a spectator.
Right, watching his own body on the road, but unable to reconnect with it. You hear accounts like this in near-death literature, don't you?
You do. Yeah. Then things get even stranger. He encounters this enigmatic, motionless figure on the road, an old woman.
Adds this layer of, well, mystery or symbolism to the whole thing.
After that, darkness. But within it, he sees a vision of his brother Charles's car crash.
And hears his friend Klein's voice, also seemingly disembodied.
Leading to this shared realization between them in that moment, we are dead.
Wow. That's incredibly chilling. A stark moment of acceptance, almost.
But then, almost immediately, comfort arrives. A booming voice says, fear not, do not be afraid.
Followed by, just call me Father. And David internally identifies this voice as Christ.
It's a deeply spiritual element woven into this traumatic experience.
What comes next is described as a panoramic mnemosyne, like a life review.
Exactly, a 360-degree cyclorama of lived moments. He re-experiences memories all the way back to being an infant, apparently very vividly.
And he also describes visiting family members, his mother, brother's father, but he calls them superluminal visitations.
Meaning faster than light. But crucially, he can't communicate with them. He's still separate.
Still detached. There's also that vision of himself.
Oh, yeah, in a white robe, hanging lifelessly. A very stark image of death.
It really seems like an acceptance of death on some level. Then comes the light.
Right. This intensely luminous, bluish-white speck appears. He merges with it, feels ecstasy, but there's also this escalating rumbling and winging.
It sounds incredibly powerful, transcendent even. But it doesn't last.
No, it's followed by what's called an agonizing reintegration back into his physical body.
A painful return to the grim, undeniable reality of his injuries. That contrast must have been jarring.
Immense. And just to add another layer, the chapter mentions someone named Leslie Harris, later revealing that David's brother, Charles, actually had a premonition about a disaster.
Oh, interesting. So, like, an external piece that seems to lend some kind of validation to the subjective experience.
That seems to be the implication, yeah. Okay, so after all that, he ends up in Peachford Hospital. The psychiatric labyrinth, the chapter calls it.
And the initial diagnosis upon admission. Acute schizophrenic. Which is, you know, a serious diagnosis related to psychosis.
David apparently pushes back immediately. He asks the doctor, Dr. Waugh, what is a schizophrenic?
He wasn't satisfied with the clinical answer he got. Felt it didn't capture what he'd experienced.
Leading to his Lynchian retort, he compares himself to an actor not knowing the next act.
It's a clever way of saying, look, my experience doesn't fit your neat little box, kind of challenging the label itself.
And when Dr. Waugh asks if he's read books about near-death experiences?
David emphatically says no. His experience wasn't like that. He says, death is right here. Very immediate, very present tense for him.
Despite all this and observation, the acute schizophrenic diagnosis stuck around for a while.
Yeah, it highlights maybe how difficult it can be for established systems to categorize experiences that fall outside the norm.
David even asks to see proof, like documented episodes of him being schizophrenic. Dr. Waugh says he'll look into it.
But when he's eventually released, the diagnosis changes. It becomes latent schizophrenia.
With the explanation that he has it under control.
David's reaction, he just laughs and says, that sounds crazy to me. You can almost hear the disbelief, right?
Absolutely. Okay, the story then jumps forward quite a bit to 2011, the maternal vigil. This focuses on his mother's health decline.
It starts seemingly small, a fall in the garden, a nagging shoulder pain.
The initial diagnosis from Dr. Marty Gibbs is a torn rotator cuff, standard stuff. She gets prescribed opioids for the pain.
But David feels uneasy. He has this intuition that it's something more.
So he decides to move in and help care for her with support from someone named Berta Sapienza. This allows him to observe her condition closely.
And based on what he sees, he starts gently questioning that rotator cuff diagnosis. He suggests maybe it's neurological.
His persistence pays off, eventually leading to a referral to a neurologist, Dr. Daniel Cobb.
But the diagnosis isn't immediate. It unfolds slowly. David notices specific things.
Yeah, like oddities in her walk, these strange pauses where she'd stand like a statue and then fall backwards.
Not typical symptoms for just a shoulder problem, you'd think?
Definitely not. Eventually, further tests are done. A DAT scan shows Parkinsonian patterns.
And an MRI reveals cortical degeneration, brain issues.
Leading to the final correct diagnosis, corticobasal degeneration. It's a rare neurological disorder.
And importantly, this allowed them to start weaning her off the opioids, which weren't treating the root cause anyway.
So the second part of this vigil deals with the terminal reality. There's mention of his sister, Carol, being in denial.
While the evidence of decline is becoming clearer, it leads to a very direct moment between David and his mother.
She asks him point blank, David, David, am I going to get better?
And he has to give her the honest, devastating answer.
Yeah.
No, ma'am, you are terminal.
As the end nears, the narrative mentions subtle signs, like the veil between worlds thinning, an erratic streetlight nearby.
And his mother starts having end-of-life visions, quite varied ones.
Yeah, God calling her, rainbows, battles with Yankees and Red Sox, even a blue-lit forest with a blue orangutan and no public bathroom.
Some very specific, unusual imagery there. And also a vision of a perfect sphere of infinite light and absolute dark.
During this time, David shares his personal belief, his belief, he calls it.
About the body being like a chrysalis.
Yes, and the spirit emerging like a butterfly. A comforting metaphor, really.
Then comes the final goodbye. A gentle smile, and David senses her spirit leaving.
But the connection doesn't seem to end there for him. He reports experiences afterwards.
Postmortem communiques, Satex calls them, like a finger pressing on his neck.
And a tug on his shirt at Disney World, of all places. Also a vivid dream where she seemed to be trying to say something, UT, UT, UT.
And a waking vision of a glowing light pattern.
For him, these are confirmations of a continued bond, a connection beyond death.
Okay, there's one more case study presented. The case of John Heiser, another instance involving medical observation.
Right. Heiser has a fall, goes to the ER. There's an initial note about possibly needing an oncology consult, a cancer check.
But somehow that concern gets dropped from his discharge papers. It's overlooked.
David apparently notices this omission, asks about it, and gets the referral reinstated.
Good thing he did. The oncologist finds surgery isn't possible. A PET scan shows cancer throughout his body.
Riddled with tumors, sadly. The prognosis is only 6 months.
They suggest palliative chemo, just for symptom management. But David reacts skeptically.
Yeah, he pushes back, focusing on quality of life, not quantity.
And then he asks a really pointed question. Heiser had recently had hip replacement surgery.
So David asks, how was the cancer in the hip missed before that major surgery?
A very valid question. The oncologist basically concedes it might have been missed.
And David then points out a shadow on an earlier x-ray, one taken before the hip replacement.
Which prompts the doctor to ask him, surprised, are you a doctor?
And David's reply is classic. No, I have just seen a lot of x-rays.
It perfectly encapsulates this recurring theme, doesn't it?
It really does. Which brings us to the final section, the uncredentialed diagnostician.
This part reflects back, even mentioning small incidents from his time at Peachford, like noticing a misplaced needle or questioning a diagnosis for another patient.
Things that, in hindsight, seem like early signs of this. Perceptual divergence.
This pattern of him noticing hidden medical issues, particularly in his family, often before the professionals, or seeing things differently.
The chapter makes a point of highlighting the contrast. No formal medical credentials, yet this consistent streak of accurate, or at least thought-provoking, insights.
It acknowledges intuition isn't foolproof, of course. Errors can happen. But it stresses this undeniable thread of accurate perception in his story.
Which leaves you wondering, where does this knowing come from? Is it trauma-induced hypersensitivity, intuition, some other kind of skill?
The text doesn't give a definitive answer. It positions David Noel Lynch as a living, breathing question mark.
Someone whose experiences challenge the idea that institutional approval, like a medical degree, equals the only form of truth or understanding.
It prompts a deeper look at what healing and understanding really mean.
So wrapping this up, what are the main takeaways from this deep dive?
Well, clearly the profound impact of trauma on perception is central. How a single event can seemingly rewire how someone experiences reality.
And it definitely explores the boundaries of consciousness, especially around near-death states. What happens? What's real?
It also shines a light on the potential limitations of conventional medicine when faced with anomalous experiences or subtle signs.
But for me, the most striking thing is this recurring power of individual, maybe intuitive, insight. David's ability to see things others missed.
Yeah, that pattern is undeniable in the narrative. Even without the credentials, his observations often prove correct or crucial.
It really makes you pause and think about how we value different kinds of knowing, doesn't it? Formal training versus lived experience or intuition.
Absolutely. So as you, the listener, think about David Noel Lynch's journey, this very unusual life shaped by trauma and these strange perceptions, maybe consider your own life.
Have there been times when your gut feeling, your intuition, or maybe just looking at something from a different angle, revealed something that the official version missed?
What might those moments suggest about the limits of our usual ways of knowing, about the potential value of perspectives that sit outside the mainstream?
It leaves us with this fascinating tension, I think. How do we navigate between respecting established knowledge and expertise while also staying open to insights that might come from unexpected, uncredentialed places?
A very provocative thought to end on. Where does true understanding lie?